to 91 FM. BBC Radio 2. Part of my next album, I'm recording 100 people saying yes.
Okay.
Hello, my name is Paul Morley, talking to you from inside a BBC recording studio. Studio 80C on the 8th floor of Broadcasting House, to be precise.
It's all about power, then, isn't it? Yeah. Simon Cowell saying yes is such a big thing.
Yep.
Gordon Brown has said no, but I'm going to record him anyway. And the Queen hasn't got back to me.
And because of the magic of the edit that messes with reality, that breaks up time, that cuts long stories short, that skips unnecessary explanation. Here I am talking to musician, DJ, composer and activist Matthew Herbert in his cosy Whitstable, Kent recording studio.
So, if you wouldn't mind saying yes, what I can do is I can take the word yes and we'll make a piece of music out of the word yes.
Interesting.
And just sort of chop it
off. Yeah, my thought, and I don't know if it's a bit cheesy, was whether to do the title of the series as well.
Okay.
And Matthew is sat with his machines, digitally manipulating, electronically constructing, magically editing up a jingle for the very radio series that you are listening to. A jingle done in the style of this week's genre.
Yes. Brilliant. Okay. And if you're doing the title of the show, do you want to do your announcement?
Is this, you want me to do this? It's not a bit Kenny Everett now. Is it? Well, you can't speak,
can you?
Paul Morley's Guide to Musical Genres.
Full marks to those of you who guessed that this week's genre, this week's experience, this week's musical story is glitch. At this point, it seems appropriate to edit, to break up into a rapid collection of words, a conversation that I had with my producer about what this week's genre typically sounds like. Difficult, complex,
bit repetitive, alien,
relentless, abstract, or intricate,
robotic, malfunction perhaps,
disorientating, frightening, soothing, emotional,
cold,
austere, very placid, frantic,
menacing.
The randomness is surprisingly organized,
dejected,
melodies mutating into alien beings with a life of their own.
The sound of dust settling on the soul.
This is the sound of tomorrow, and here's one we prepared earlier. I've got one more for that section. Sometimes it can just sound like the moisture in your mouth.
Okay, so we've got that.
Yes. Yes.
One of the things I've learnt in this series is that talking about the history of recently named genres like glitch, which evolved and then to an extent dissolved or disintegrated into numerous subcategories in the late 1990s, is that really we're talking about the latest stages in a musical journey that began decades before. As time goes by, numerous new styles based on refining and redefining old sounds needed new genre names. And by the end of the 20th century, ready for the invention of the iPod, this started to mean hundreds of new genre names, like glitch.
Yes.
So as you can hear immediately, you've got the S on the yes, suggests a rhythm, so you've got...
Yes.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. So you've got a tempo there, that sort of thing.
Yes.
Which is not that far off from what it was set up. So the first thing that you do is
Yes.
Studying glitch is really studying some of the more recent, most extreme stages in a history of electronic music that began around the middle of the 20th century and travelled from elitist academic laboratories, exploring the properties, functions and mysteries of sound into the very bloodstream of popular music.
You then speed
up. Yes.
Speed up the loop. And then you would make it a very uneven, sort of tight loop. That kind of thing. Change the loop around so you have a little bit of that high speed one, and then you have the next bit of that. So, and then maybe the yes. So by just chopping up that audio file, your first 4 seconds could just be
yes.
Through glitch, we're also examining the development of the microphone, the tape and the recording studio, and the impact that the recording studio has had on the history of popular music, technologically extending the limits of sound and constantly encouraging innovation.
And then you can do what's called time stretching.
Yes.
I could listen to that.
Yes. Yes. Not just because it's my voice, because it's not my voice. Yes.
We're also exploring the invention and reinvention of the computer and the history of a kind of computer-generated music inspired by pop sounds and the avant-garde that is often made by composers who are not necessarily musicians.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
So what I've done is I've just taken a 1 second sample of random sections of that, so I don't know what's come out here.
These composers manipulate textures, sounds, effects and rhythms and their imagination into a synthetic approximation, a sonic simulation, a representation of a piece of music.
So we've got a little click there, which is, that's a mistake, or that's a digital error or something like that. But that becomes like a nice little something that you can do something rhythmic with.
Yes. Yes.
Music is made not necessarily using conventional musical instruments. If musical instruments are used, they are often not used conventionally. It's musical composition as a sort of sculpture, and sometimes this approximation is so meticulously achieved, you cannot detect how much electronic ingenuity was involved in its production.
And then if we maybe start applying some plugins.
Yes. 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 Yes.
Sometimes, as with Glitch, you can definitely hear the join. You can feel the machinery, see the wires and the wheels turning, sense mathematical calculation. The point of this music is its disorientating, sensational otherness.
Then we can apply like a reverb on it. And this being modern technology, you have sampled reverb. So basically you can have an old forest.
Yes. Yeah, 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 yeah. Yeah.
This is the way that technology, you know, like, starts leading you in certain directions, you know, it's encouraging you to sort of
yes,
do
it. Yes.
Do
things. Singing my own song now.
Yeah, exactly. You're gonna have to pay your publisher if you realise. Every time you say it now.
Claim me 25%, man, I will do it.
To an extent, all pop music is made this way, an assembly, a collage, a transformation of tones, details, references and noises, of electronically captured voices and sound artificially layered and willed into shape.
So say that's the beginnings of our slightly peculiar song.
Yeah, 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 yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Now we have like a new piece of audio to mess with.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then you could just overlay that to what you'd already done.
Yes. 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 Yes.
And you've got an Arts Council grant.
An edit has enabled me to travel from Matthew Herbert's studio in Whitstable to Studio ATC at Broadcasting House, where I'm contemplating the genre known as Glitch. Glitch is part of a history of the edit and its impact on our sense of movement through time. And Glitch is also part of a history of electronic music that goes from Doctor Who, theme tune created by the pioneering sound gurus, the BBC Radiophonic Workshop, to Dr. Dre. From Chicory Tip to Hot Chip. Devo to LCD Sound System. From Wendy Carlos to Kraftwerk. Another digital edit will bring me to my next guests, who I'm putting into the Glitch program, even though they naturally didn't set out to be a Glitch group. Like most musicians, they didn't set out to be fitted inside any named box. In fact, they set out to move outside the box, to avoid the labels that get attached to sounds. Occasionally, they do have to plainly describe what music they make.
We were coming back from the airport yesterday and our driver was saying, so what's it like, your music? I said, it's kind of hard, sort of electronic. Sometimes you can play it in a club, sometimes you can listen to it at home. She went, ah, Electric Light Orchestra. And I went, my mum's got loads of their albums. I'd rather look at the albums than listen to the track.
No, but then she said Santana.
I said, no, it's more talk, it's more electronic. She went, oh, Santana. So, yeah. So it is tough, it's impossible, really.
Yeah. Manchester-based Sean Booth and Rob Brown are Otekra, which they say can be pronounced in a number of ways, and they have been since the early 90s. You might not have heard of them, but I'm going to say to you, as long as this next bit isn't edited out, they are perhaps one of the greatest, well, I was going to say pop, so I will. One of the greatest pop groups of all time. Odd pop group, though. They started out as disc jockeys with an obsession with radical, demented dance music, and then evolved into musicians melting down or cutting up the fundamentally escapist idea of dance music, smashing up even obliterating beat, and using the mutant beauty of melody as a reflection of desolation. The 12 minutes I spent talking about their sustained ability to produce cryptically titled music that sounds like they've recorded the shredded dreams and nightmares that machines are having about human desire has been edited out. So I'll mention instead that they've been described as the Led Zeppelin of glitch, or that they've ripped apart acid house and early hip-hop and put it back together again as cubist dub cult microtonal wrecked funk. There's a genre name for you. Sean and Rob, for all their shadowy distance as a group, are fairly pragmatic about the modern craving for the soothing, classifying guidance of genrefication.
We were electronica at first, and then we were intelligent techno, and then we were IDM.
Yeah.
Nowadays, it's largely depends on the journalist's background, what genre they think is most applicable for that day. Techno weirdos or electronic superstars or, well, you know, some odd combination of words that don't really make sense. But
You spend all this time spreading your wings, getting yourself known for as much freedom as possible, creative freedom, and then someone's clipping them back, you know. Oh, it's just this tiny little parcel of information that's supposed to describe a world of ideas, if you like, and it tends to just describe one or two elements in most people's heads, you know.
Do you note the influence on people who come to see you from the way you've been described or defined by a genre name, or is it more fluid than that?
It's a bit more fluid than
that. I bet it has a bearing on it, definitely.
We'd just been around America and there were loads of young people and they were reacting in a really odd way. They were kind of stood round and it was like they were on a roller coaster. Whenever something exhilarating happened, they'd all go, yes, woo! But they were just standing there. It was like a complete non-raver crowd.
You know?
To us, it was like really kind of new and alien and exciting, but it was weird. We felt free to do what we wanted creatively, but we weren't getting a reaction we were used to. It's a strange one, because there's a lot more girls this time, a lot more black people. Partly that's down to social networking and people finding it necessary to show that they're into a wide range of things.
Yeah.
Because you've got on a MySpace page, for example, you know, an opportunity to put down your influences and your tastes, and people like to show diversity because they want to cover as many bases as possible. Yeah. They want to look that way. And so it's sort of benefited people like us in a way.
Essentially, IDM and then Glitch used the appeal of post-rave techno and hip-hop and the cultural appetite for fresher rhythms and weirder noises to smuggle through challenging sounds and ideas influenced by the avant-garde. Ortega's direct inspiration was acid house, early hip-hop and techno, and the attempt to absorb and decipher the sonic and mental excitement of this music led them further and further into the intricately experimental.
We'd grown up listening to the weird bits in hip-hop tracks and the fact that these guys had, you know, no equipment and were intensely creative people. I mean, for a brief period in the mid-80s, hip-hop was about using a studio, the same kind of studio the next guy down the road had, but in a madder way, in a fresher way. Hip-hop almost didn't have any identifiable facets other than that it had a bit of rapping or scratching in it, maybe. There was so many new records that were coming out that were fresh. I guess that just sort of made us think that that was what music should be. When it started to stagnate in around 87, 88, 89 with the sampler and everything else, it just became all about loops. We became a lot less interested and started getting into acid house. And
it caught us at such an age that we were 13 and 14 when hip-hop and electron, there was scratching and turntable stuff. There was BMX, there was graffiti, there was breakdancing, there was the clothing as well. It just all hit us like a wave, and I think us and our friends responded.
A lot of those movements share a kind of personal development thing, where you, if you're on a BMX, say, you're going to just sit outside in the street constantly practicing the same moves until you get it right. And with breakdancing too, you've got that, and both of them also have this element of, if you can come up with something new, then you're going to get ultimately rewarded for it. And hip-hop was very much about that for a while, before it became a flag-waving genre. We were lucky in a way, in that we've been influenced by people who didn't have any equipment, and we were trying to make as many different things as we could with hardly any equipment. Nowadays, the chances of somebody getting into that position are really low, given the proliferation of software.
But in a way, that was an advantage for you, I guess, that you really had to force yourself against limited possibilities to create extensive possibilities.
That was the fun, that was the attraction.
Precisely.
It's like a red flag to a bull, basically, those apparent limitations, because it was like, well, what wire can go into what socket, you know? It's electricity, there's got to be something happening somewhere in one direction or another, let's just turn the gear on and try all these silly things out, unspecified things with this gear, and found latent possibilities in nearly every device we had. and didn't really look for anything expensive. Like, a lot of friends were going, oh, well, I'm going to buy this big thing, I'm going to save up for this. And we just made sure that we pooled our resources and kept it small and understood every single bit of gear we had as deeply as we knew how.
Paul Morley's Guide to Musical Genres.
Before I turn into Max Headroom, the Benny Hill of Glitch, time to be edited back to Matthew Herbert's Whitstable studio.
Well, one thing when I was growing up that I was sort of a bit annoyed about was that I missed punk. You know, I was born in 72 and I missed punk, and I was sort of growing up, I felt like I didn't have a youth movement. And then come 16, you suddenly realise you're bang in the middle of acid house.
Matthew Herbert, along with San Francisco duo Matmos, composed dance music using organic samplers. Hip-hop had recycled songs, rhythms and instruments, which had become a cultural cul-de-sac. By using increasingly more sophisticated sampling technology, Matmos and Herbert idealistically reconfigured the playful way that music concrete composers had crudely pieced together their compositions from natural sounds.
One of the most incredible gifts that a musician could ever have emerged in the mid-90s, which was the sampler. So instead of music having to be about the bucolic beauty of the Kent countryside, you could actually go out with a microphone, record some hay coming in and a few birds, bring it back to the studio and make the piece of music out of that. So music no longer had to be descriptive. It no longer had to be abstract. It could be the actual thing.
The other thing about the techniques you were using and that way of making sound is how it was absorbed into the mainstream, is that you're very likely to see a kind of electroacoustic piece of music, if you like, you know, sell a BMW car or something. The fact that the very glossy commercial companies can see something in this sort of jumpy, jerky, glitchy, you know, almost sometimes the sound of dust mating, and they think this could sell our incredibly expensive £40,000 saloon car.
I think what electronic music at its best can do using the sampling technology is to join the dots, is to relate directly the thing that you see to the thing that you hear. So, for example, on a car advertising, if you see a door closing and you hear that sound, you automatically join the thing together. It's like glue. The music is like artistic glue that can bring it all together. And this is what I mean about the revolution of the sampler. It's given freedoms now that we never had before, because previously people would have had to have sat down at a piano and tried to sum up a BMW 3 Series turbo diesel coupe with a piano. I mean, I don't quite know how you would do it, other than trying to maybe do a bit of rumbling with the left hand to the engine, or maybe slam the lid down to do the door or something like that. So I don't think that we should be surprised. I mean, in some ways it's depressing that advertising agencies have noticed that possibility more than the music industry has, or the creative side of the music part has, you know.
It's true, because a lot of the music that goes under Glitch, you know, if you said you were going to play it, say, on this programme on Radio 2, you know, there would be a kind of horror that it's unlistenable, that it's just noise.
Yeah.
And yet, A, oddly, there's a lot of beauty in there, and B, it's music that in another context they probably listen to already and don't actually know that they do.
Yeah.
One of the things I'm interested in is taking a genre, say Glitch, and then taking it back to the most absurd source possible you can imagine. You know, sometimes everything always seems to go back to Noel Coward or Gilbert Sullivan, we've noticed lately. But where would you see it beginning?
For me, the biggest proponent of Glitch would be Thelonious Monk. Because, again, you don't know what's coming next, and yet it has the most joyful sort of stride, and it has a curious mind behind it. But it has technique, it has skill, and it has the perfect combination of the heart and the soul and the spirit of the musician, but it has a technique that has never really existed before, and it has a skill as well that most musicians don't have. I mean, I certainly would like that kind of skill if I could, please.
Great, Thelonious Monk.
Yeah.
That's a good one.
Yeah.
An edit here can, as edits wonderfully suddenly do, take us back 30 years. Around the time of punk in the late 1970s, some non-musicians wanting to make music but feeling that guitars weren't the way to reject the cliched rock past were enlightened by metaphysical magician Brian Eno. They were inspired by his role in Roxy Music, his sexy partnership with David Bowie, and his pop interpretation of the ideas of Steve Reich, John Cage, and the Velvet Underground. To edit a long story short, the history of electronic music that led to Glitch travelled via the future yearning likes of the Human League, The Normal, Thomas Lear, Cabaret Voltaire, Orchestral Maneuvers in the Dark, and the early Ultravox, years before Midge-Ure took them on a cheap city break to Vienna. So is electronic music a way for non-musicians to make music?
Yeah. Phil Oakey has a good line on that where he said it was more punk than punk because you only had to use one finger.
Were you a non-musician?
Yeah.
Ultravox were originally led by John Fox, and he helped establish the British electropop template as a combination of technology and fantasy, of pop music and inner space. He imagined a brave new world where the space-age synthesizer would replace the woody guitar.
When I was at art school, I found an ARP synthesizer upstairs, and I just started fiddling about with it, and I realized you could make these very interesting sounds with it. And the thing that really interested me was that if you used it for itself, without trying to imitate anything else, which I couldn't anyway, you got some pretty interesting effects with it. And they weren't just effects, but they were solid sounds that you could build into something that resembled a song. Also, trying to use drum machines was another thing, because I thought it was great not to use a drummer.
Why was that?
Well, drummers were a pain, you know. You had to use dozens of microphones, and it took ages to set up if you tried to record them, and it was just so unwieldy.
Yeah.
I just thought, this is great, little cocktail thing, you know, that people use for cocktail cabaret. And actually, when you amplified that, there were some pretty powerful and surprising sounds in it, really explosive sounds.
Was there any tradition of the kind of music that you wanted to make that you felt that you were continuing, or did you actually feel that you were beginning from scratch?
I felt like I was beginning from scratch at the time, but I realised that there's all this other stuff that I'd learned at art school, you know, the futurist bit.
Mm.
That idea that there's an aesthetic to machinery and you can enjoy the uglier side of life, which I'd been brought up in near where you were, in Manchester, or at the edge of Manchester, which was all factories and so on. And it was like revenge on the factories to use those sounds to make music with. And it was delicious to be able to do that. And when I realised I was doing that, I really got into it, because that made sense, gave me a context, you know, to work with.
And you kind of invent your own world, your own cities.
Yeah, it's partly to do with adequacy, because you can't live in the real world yourself, so you have to make one up. What really got me into it, though, was the Beatles. Tomorrow Never Knows. That knocked me to bits. Mm. Just that track.
Mm.
And I just played it. I remember playing it about 40 times one night when it first came out. Some of the older students came in and said, listen to this. Turn off your mind, relax and float downstream. So we played it all night. I thought, that's brilliant. Listen to that. Just listen to it. What is it? It's not dying. It had stuff in it that you never heard before. You know, it was the first drum loops, first samples, it was all on tape, reverse noises and a chant.
Mm.
And I recognised every element in it, but I'd never heard them all together. And I didn't know what a drum loop was.
Yes.
But it was that lovely, delicious repetition, you know, patterning, kind of patterning that was like from another world. It was just wonderful stuff.
And of course it was from another world. It was from a recording studio, and they were becoming other worlds, weren't they?
Absolutely. It was the first track that couldn't have existed outside a recording studio.
Mm.
You couldn't play that. And that was part of its appeal, I think.
An edit, telling a story of electronic music that goes from Herbert's ideological fascination with the meaning of sound to John Fox's love for sound as a way of describing an imaginary time and place. The successful pop group, The Beatles, experimenting with far-out sound to demonstrate how fast their imagination and the world around them was moving. And of course, eventually, all music, you know, all popular music in a way is electronic. Even if it doesn't sound like it, all records nowadays are fundamentally electronic.
They always have been, too. Ever since blues hit Chicago, because before then he had acoustic instruments, guitars and so on, harmonicas. As soon as those black workers went into the steel mills in Chicago and in Detroit in the motor trade, they got enough money to buy amps. And that was the beginning of electronic music proper, because you could amplify this stuff, and they weren't restricted by making a thing sound nice or sound like the original. They were just using the guitar as a source to manipulate, mutilate sound in a delicious, beautiful way that made you just want to jump up and down. I remember hearing, when I was a kid, Smokestack's Lightning by Howlin' Wolf.
Oh, Smokestack Lightning,
the best sound I've ever heard in my life. I didn't know what it was, but it was so abstract, that harmonica and that riff and that guitar.
This history of electronic music demonstrates how the militant digital developments of Glitch blipped, nerved and screwed via the likes of micro-sampling Prefuse 73 into hip-hop, so that there was Glitch Hop, and then the glam pop side of Glitch Hop, as masterminded by the hypertech producer Timbaland. Timbaland creamed off the contagious, defective attraction of Glitch and hit the masses with it.
Personally, I think you can trace the death of Glitch, or the death of electronic music, or the death of proper experimental electronic music to Get Your Freak On by Missy Elliott. Because basically Timbaland and Missy Elliott came along and took the best ideas, in a way, of the genre and made it catchy and made it poppy. And actually after that, it put a massive hole in the boat, I think, and it's been going down ever since, really. Missy be putting it down, I'm the hottest
round, I told your mother. Well, from the practitioners of Glitch itself as well.
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
It's been taken away from them, but not taken away from them in a diluted way, actually. I think that's being transfigured and transformed in an amazing way.
Yeah, made a lot better.
They didn't have the techniques to do the next stage.
Yeah, again, it took someone to do something soulful with it. It was actually Tim Lennon and Missy Elliott that turned it into gold, I think. It's just technique, ultimately. You know, what it is just a technique of dealing with audio, and that will just absolutely be everywhere. I think it'll be redundant if it isn't already.
Because it's been absorbed.
Because it's been absorbed, and because it, you know, in a way, we're like the sort of people walking through a field, and you leave a few footmarks, and a few people sort of follow you down, and then basically someone comes along and sort of tarmacs that path and puts up little chefs on either side of the road. And then the footpath isn't necessary anymore because there's a, whatever, there's three lanes of motorway down it.
Glitch is an extreme dissonant reflection of how pop music is made by obsessive technicians stuck inside studios or in front of laptops, working out how to squeeze surprising new sounds from complex technology for the sake of modern entertainment. Glitch might sound like an algebra equation set to music, or the soulless sound of machinery chattering to itself, or the art of making wonky music for the sake of it. But it's a clear sighting of the research and development side of music that eventually makes it into the mainstream, into a Girls Aloud or Madonna remix, into the digital repairing of Rihanna or Kylie's voice. It infects Björk, Beck and Radiohead, and even drifts into the kind of pop song, The District Sleeps Alone Tonight by the Postal Service, which you wouldn't be alarmed to hear on daytime radio too. And to help link us to next week's programme on perfect pop, and I've got my idea what that might be, and I bet you've got yours, how about this famous piece of digitally adjusted funny business from Cher, a great pop song made on machines and pretty much sung by one. You've been listening to
Paul Morley's Guide to Musical Genres.
The producer was Paul Kobrak, who's going to have the last edit.
your phone, isn't it? Actually. You just switch your phone on, isn't it?
That's a classic glitch thing to include that. It's a glitch cliche.
We should have it all the way through, just mobile phones going off.
Yeah, yeah, that's true.
When you're two commissioning editors knocking at the door saying, what are you doing in there? Not playing Thelonious Monkey, are you?
Exactly.
This is BBC Radio 2, online, on digital, and on 88 to 91 FM. BBC News at midnight, this is Fenella Fudge. The two sides in the petrol tanker pay dispute have reached an agreement tonight. A second four-day strike that was due to start on Friday has been suspended. The details of the deal will be put to Shell drivers in a ballot. Bernie Holloway of the haulage firm Hoyer said he was very pleased with the outcome.
I think it's fair to say that there were compromises on both sides in order, and there had to be, in order for that to be achieved. But the important thing was there was massive pressure on all sides to conclude this. There was no desire, obviously, for a repeat of last weekend's disruption. And we're delighted to say that we have achieved that and that there will now be a return to normal working.
A report into the London Olympics commissioned by the new mayor, Boris Johnson, says the projected overall cost of the Games has risen by more than £100 million since last November. The report has also highlighted concerns over security for the event. The radical Islamic preacher Abu Qatada has been released from prison on bail. He's fighting extradition to Jordan, where he's been convicted of terrorism offences. A judge has already ruled that he should remain in Britain, but the Home Office is appealing against that decision. Our security correspondent Frank Gardner says he'll be under close scrutiny.
The police and the security services, I think, are not entirely certain about whether he still poses a national threat, a threat to national security. So they're not taking any chances. They're putting him under very strict bail conditions, incredibly strict, 22 hours a day confined to his house, no mobiles or access to the internet, not even allowed a visit to a mosque in case he indoctrinates anybody else.
A teenager's in a critical condition in hospital after being stabbed in South London. Police say he was involved in an altercation with a group of youths in a street in Southwark. The Governor of the Bank of England, Mervyn King, has warned that inflation could rise above 4% later this year as food and energy prices soar. He's had to write to the Chancellor to explain why the Consumer Prices Index went up from 3 to 3.3% last month, its highest level for more than a decade. The former Chancellor, Lord Lawson, was asked whether Britain was heading for recession.
Well,